Well, g'day, and I don't even know where to start this episode. I had the chance to head up to Townsville and see the team at DRT AgTech and sit down with Mark Pitt for this one. And one besides Mark being one of the fittest 50-something-year-old in taking me on a 7-kilometre run around Townsville, this Geelong boy cannot handle humidity very well. That's the first thing I learned. I think the big thing that kind of came through for me, I've probably reflected on and I've shared with a few other people, is how Mark talks about the importance of purpose within his business, but also the importance of profit being a very close second. And I think it's something that we probably don't really talk about a lot in business and what we do, but ultimately, if we want to be able to do good today, tomorrow, next week, next year, and into the future, we've got to make sure that we're in a position where we can kind of keep showing up as well. So Mark's a fascinating dude. He talks about how in his 30s, he was working as a pilot up in Northern Australia, and he decided that he'd take his career and life in a different direction. He talks about the importance of family, and today, I guess, taking on big challenges and thinking differently, whether it was crowdfunding and handing over equity to employees and other people to help propel their business forward. He really thinks about doing business in a different way, ultimately trying to do better for himself and the environment and now with what they're doing in and around the methane reduction space. It's bloody fascinating and interesting. So if you want to find out more and you want me to stop talking, let's jump into this episode and have a squiz at your show notes. This episode, we're sitting down with Mark Pitt. And Mark, you put me through the ringer a little bit this morning. You actually made me run. We're channeling Cameron Haynes, and I was thinking about it this morning. I think what we did a run, a swim with jellyfish, and then avoid a crocodile attack. So that's, I guess, our three. They're slightly different when you're in North Queensland.
It is.
Mate, welcome to the Humans of Agriculture podcast.
Thank you, Ollie. I've heard a lot about you, and I appreciate you coming all the way up to Townsville here to hear the DIT story and spend a couple of days. It's been great.
Mate, it's been fantastic. I really enjoyed meeting your team yesterday and looking forward to spending a bit more time with them as well. But I think I'm interested. You're a fascinating fella. I think as I was reading your bio and your profile online, you talk about the importance of purpose, but also the importance of profit. And I think when it comes to business, lots of people can kind of shy away from that. I think purpose obviously is what aligns and drives people and builds unity and vision, but profit's pretty important in business. So I'm keen to flesh that out with you.
I've got some strong views on that. Yeah.
Mate, I guess just starting off, like, tell me a little bit about where you grew up. What have been the early influences in your life that have sent you down this pathway of starting your own company, especially kind of in agriculture?
So I grew up in sort of central and western Queensland. My dad managed sheep and cattle stations. Pretty typical sort of, you know, station manager's son, went to a little country school. We moved around a bit as dad managed different places, went to boarding school in Toowoomba. Now I went to Gatton Ag for a year. You know, I wanted to do something in agriculture, I think because my father had been in agriculture. So, you know, that was a strong thing that I wanted to do. But I went to Gatton Ag thinking that I would take a career in it, and it sort of sidestepped into my career in aviation. And after I did 1 year at Gatton, and like most young guys, I was just had enough of school and, you know, so I deferred for a year and went to the Territory Ringing in 1986 on Delamere Station. And that was a pretty defining part of my life because that's where I was exposed to see helicopters air and mustering. And I'd always had a passion for aviation as a kid, you know, from a little 2-year-old, 3-year-old standing at a fence watching planes take off. It was something I always wanted to do. I never thought I'd be able to become a pilot, but at Delamere, when I was there in the camp, I can still remember it. You know, that was back in the days. There was no social media in the camps then. You know, we wouldn't go to town for 3 months. All Indigenous stockmen there. So there was only 2 non-Indigenous people, myself and the head stockman, camped out all the time. And I can remember sitting on a ridge, we were yarding up a mob of cattle there, and the head stockman was telling me, we were watching a chopper put cattle in the yard, an old Bell 47. He said, Mark, you know, those helicopter pilots make $500 a week. And I thought, holy geez, $500 a week. I'm on $120 a week. I'm going to become a helicopter pilot. So that's sort of started my career into aviation and then, yeah, a lot of other businesses. But I've always been motivated, yeah, I suppose, to sort of challenge myself and do something that I felt was really hard to do. And it's taken me a while, mate. I'm 57 years old this year. And I say to my team, you know, my eyesight is failing every day, but I think my vision is getting stronger. And that didn't happen overnight. So they were very big influences, my aviation career early on to where we are here.
You are 57. I think we can touch on that. You don't run like you're a 57-year-old, because I reckon towards the end of that 6 and a bit case, I was probably thinking, God, hopefully he doesn't just keep turning left and taking us further away from where we're going to end up.
Well, I've done a lot of it, so thanks. I appreciate that.
Mate, you say you thought you'd never be or could be a pilot. Like, why?
Because it's really expensive. You know, back then there was no tertiary assistance like there is now. You can get HECS now to become a pilot. You know, I think when I did my chopper license, it was $30,000. And, you know, I was only making about $6,000 a year. So it was a bit, it was a big financial commitment. And I think when I put together the money to get my license, because my mum and dad didn't have the ability to support me or help me with that. Initially, I thought that was a barrier, but I just realized that I was 19 at the time, that if you want something, you got to rock up. You know, you got to get to the line, you got to try to work out how you're going to do it. And even just to put together $30,000, you know, that took some hustling. I had multiple credit cards, I sold all my horses, I was breaking in horses, I got rid of them, sold my saddle, sold my Holden ute, sold everything, and finally was able to put together the money to get my chopper license and go forward. And that set the scene, I think, in life for me that, you know, there's always a way to get, if you're really passionate about something, there's always a way to get there.
Was it everything that you'd hoped and dreamed of? Like, you'd obviously sacrificed a lot. You'd toiled a heck of a lot to kind of get that chopper license. Was it what you were expecting when you stepped into the chopper?
I was the luckiest guy in the world. I loved it. Like, it was a really, it was a defining part of my life being a helicopter pilot. I love flying. You know, I loved the bush. I loved the freedom. It was like being a mustering pilot back in the 80s and the 90s, especially in the 80s, you know, you were like an astronaut. There wasn't, like, there's a helicopter pilot under every rock now in the north, as I say, but back then there wasn't many. So it was special, but the isolation, the time by myself, the time to visualize what I wanted to do with my life, the people I met, people ask me now, you know, I did nearly 18,000 hours of mustering, and people say to me, do I miss helicopter mustering? I actually don't miss banging cows in the yard day in, day out, 13 hours a day, away from home 6 weeks at a time, camped in my swag. I actually miss the things that I never took for granted when I was flying, like lying in my swag at night looking at the stars. You know, I miss that. Flying the helicopter back home after mustering along the coast in Cape York and the sun going down and seeing dugongs in the water. And like all of those at the time were fluffy things, but retrospectively, that's what I miss on it. But DIT's been great because it's really connected me back to where I think my roots were in the beginning. And I know that industry really well because of my career as a chopper pilot.
Why'd you move on?
From helicopters?
Yeah.
But I had a good business. You know, I was doing contract mustering with a mate and I was doing a few other things, recruiting, and I've always been really entrepreneurial. You know, and I don't like saying the word entrepreneurial. I think I've always been really creative and forming a business from nothing and building teams and even branding and marketing. Like I really like that and I've always liked it. But I got to about 35, yeah, I'm a bit older, and at the time I wouldn't tell many people this, yeah, my wife knows, but I just didn't feel like I was really what I was made out to do. I didn't feel like I was being useful.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like there was a real purpose. I just felt that there was something else I could do with my life and I didn't know at the time. So I sort of sold up and sold this and got out of it. And yeah, moved into other things. And then there was a bit of a segue into DIT and how I came about in ag tech. But it was, yeah, it's taken me a while to find where I meant to be, you know.
What's it like at 35? I guess everything you knew up to that point, thought you wanted to do, coming to that realization that maybe where you were at that point in time wasn't probably where you're destined to be. And I think that we'll probably talk about, I guess, the signs of the universe, which I think is actually really cool how you said that. But at 35, a wife, did you have kids?
No, I didn't have any kids then. But yeah, I'd sort of, it was probably my identity, giving up my identity. I had a good business. I knew everyone. It was sort of who I was, but I was reinventing my identity. I was actually excited about it, Ollie.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what was in front of me. At 35, I never thought that I'd be leading an ag tech business and, you know, a public company and doing all this stuff in climate change. I never thought that in my wildest dreams. However, I sort of knew that I was going to do something. But I had to find it. It took me a while to find it. And that was a journey in itself to come across ag tech.
And so, like, we've got lots of young people and probably mid-career professionals that listen to the podcast and things like that. And this question that people get asked of what's your 3-year goal, what's your 5-year goal? Like, how important was it? Like, did you have career plans and things? And how, I guess, granular were you with that?
Probably obsessively. Like, I was, you know, I can still remember I wrote a list of all these things I wanted to do in my life. Went to the US with my wife. She was my girlfriend then. And I can remember reading or listening to Anthony Robbins' books and reading all this stuff on self-help and how important it was actually writing down things I wanted to achieve in my life. So I still have a list of all these things I want to do with a box, and I tick them off. And I've ticked a lot off, and there's still a few more to go. And I still have them in a special place and I look at them. So I think it's really important. Goals are really important for humans to feel like we're living a useful life. I'm a bit older now, so I think a lot more about, you know, where I've come from and why I've behaved in certain ways, good and bad. And it's all that fabric of life, mate. But it's really important that we have goals. You know, it helps us get out of bed in the morning. But the problem is not enough people have goals that are really important to them. We do things that we think society expects us to do. Agriculture is a prime example. We were talking about it, you know, probably the succession you see of young people on the land who love agriculture, but then at the same time, their passion might have been somewhere else, but they were expected to stay. And then we have people who are really passionate about agriculture, but they can't get into it for finance and they end off doing something else, was what they never really wanted to do.
Mm. Let's talk about that evolution. 35, you walk away. What did you and Fiona, you left the Northern Territory in Queensland where you were calling home at the time?
Yeah, we were living in Corumba, yep, in the Gulf. I had a mushroom business there. So I started to look at other things to do. I worked with a group, built a feedlot in North Queensland, and, you know, that was pretty entrepreneurial. I had a few shares in that and I learned a few lessons about business and corporates and got pushed out of it. But that was a big learning curve. I then got into some property developing before the GFC. So I was looking around. I read about these people making all this money building apartments in Cairns and looked into it and thought, that doesn't seem very hard. So I had a crack at that. And before the GFC, I made a lot of money. You know, again, the universe has a funny way of humbling us. And I got humbled. I thought I was the smartest man in the room. And I got smashed before the GFC, lost everything. And I was in Indonesia at the time doing some flying, some contract flying. I went over there for 18 months. And I got a phone call from a good friend of mine, Dean and Colin McKenna down in Warrnambool. And Colin rang up and said, look, I want to buy a jet. You know, would you help us sort of do the acquisition and find it? And he said to me, if you want to fly it, you can fly it. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I could do that. So I actually did. I quit my job in Indonesia and I needed a job. So I went to the US, bought Colin and Dean their jet. And did my license and flew it home back to Australia. And that started my corporate career that I've been doing for the last 15 years flying them. But that was a big time. I went and worked for Colin for 4 years in Warrnambool. So Fiona and I moved down there. I'd always been a North Queensland or Northern Australian guy. And that was a real change moving to Victoria. 4 years. But I had to because I needed a job, mate. You know, I needed a job to feed my family. And that was when, look, and I had a tick on my box that I wanted to do an MBA. So I thought about, well, this is a good time to see if I could do that. So I got in contact with the uni in Melbourne at Deakin. And because I didn't have a degree from Ag College, I only had a diploma, I couldn't get straight into an MBA program. So I had to do a certificate first. So I did the certificate first, and then they invited me into the master's program. So I did my MBA down there. And it was during that time I came across the word AgTech. I majored in finance and corporations law. And it was actually doing a finance module on valuing Facebook. It was just before Facebook IPO'd.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fascinated with the way they'd raise capital and venture capitalists and this do this and tech business. And I was just researching and I came across this word AgTech. Yeah, that was it, mate. I don't want to make it sound too fluffy, but it lit a fire inside of me. And it was like, hey, I'm going to build a tech business in the bush. That's what I was meant to do. So that was in 2009. Here we are now in 2024.
So 2009, and I guess the other question I've got, Fiona, you've mentioned her a few times. What role did mentors and other people have? Like you mentioned Tony Robbins, so the self-help and that side of things, lots of time kind of by yourself flying and whatnot, thinking. Who was also on the outside for you to chat to?
Do you know, there were people who I respected in the beef industry, people that, you know, I'd listen to. I wish I'd tried a bit harder to get a mentor. I think that's really important when you're young because I think I could have accelerated some of the things I wanted to do if I'd had that, but it took me a while. My wife has been a tremendous support. Fiona's been a tremendous support. She's allowed me to be creative and take risks and, you know, go down these rabbit holes and explore these things. And she stood beside me when I failed. And, you know, like Fiona and I know what it's like to do really, really hard. And I wear that as a bit of a badge of honor. I'm embarrassed by some of it, but I think it has definitely defined and has made my life much more exciting and valuable because of failure.
So 2009, you've completed your MBA, you've come across this thing, ag tech. Did you have an idea? Was there something that you saw as an opportunity that you could have your mark on?
Yeah, so I did. Early on, I noticed a couple of things about the cycle with ag tech. The best way to describe it is I saw early on that tech was disrupting every other industry, but it hadn't really disrupted agriculture. However, if you look at what all that previous tech disruption was around social media and smartphones, and really all it gave us was humanity, entertainment, and convenience. But I could see that, hey, you know, this ag tech could be really big industry because it's so important, food security and sustainability and agriculture would play. Even early on around, you know, the climate debate, you could see that, you know, there was things in nature and farming. So that was exciting. So I knew that there would be a big opportunity because I knew extensive ag really well. I wanted to start something that we could solve a problem straight away for farmers, because I think we get off track in ag tech a little bit. We create these novel things that the market's great tech, but the market's not ready for it. You've got to be really customer centric. And in extensive agriculture, the second biggest cost we have is supplementation. And we're putting lick blocks and dry licks on the bag, on the ground. You know, like 10,000 years ago, caveman was putting stuff on the ground to attract animals. And here we are, all the leading producers were still doing it. So we decided that we would explore water supplementing. But my father had a little bit of legacy in that. He'd had a little supplement business and he had actually sold doses. He and his brother was probably the entrepreneur or the scientist that invented the first water medicator to put urea in the water. So I used a bit of that legacy and planning. And yeah, that was at the back of what we started DIT off.
Was it something that you'd been exposed to, 3-year-old man, or was it kind of, yeah, so you knew how things kind of work?
But I knew all the problems because he had a lot of problems to get through. There was a lot of innovation that hadn't been solved, from tech innovation to chemistry innovation. So there were a lot of things that had to be solved, make water supplementing or that production scalable. But we identified that there was money to be made there. And like what you were saying in the beginning, like we could do something. And DIT sort of expanded to be even more purposeful in my mind since then. But at the time, we knew that we could get revenue and profit from it. We had to just work it out and we could build a business around it, which we've been very lucky about.
So if I'd seen and bumped into you back in those early days, what was the vision and what did the business kind of look like and who was around you?
In DIT in the very early days?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
First employee went on in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
You would have seen a lot of chaos, Ollie. That's what you would have seen. You know, we had to raise money. We didn't know whether we had product fit. We didn't know how to, like, just building the tech was so hard. I don't have a tech background. We've just had so many people had to help us with that. And it took a while to build a tech team to be able to build all that. So, a lot of difficult times, tech not working, having to raise capital all the time to stay alive. But I think you would have definitely seen that we wanted to build something there, that there was an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's evolving every day, DIT. And, you know, we can talk about climate, the stuff we're doing in climate now. I think that ag tech and climate tech are going to be huge businesses in agriculture and society in the next 50 years. Huge businesses.
So I just want to jump back. There's a bit of time between 2009 when the idea kind of started and bringing on that first employee. In that period as well, you became a dad?
I did. Yeah. I became a dad in 2005.
Okay.
2005. So I had one child, Mitchy. He'd come along in our life then.
How did being a dad, I guess, either add to what were the superpowers within it, but also what, I guess, did it complicate as well as you were starting an early stage business?
Well, it definitely adds to the risk profile.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got this other responsibility. I think the thing I've learned the most about being a dad, you know, starting a business like this is the importance of compartmentizing work from family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was younger, when I had businesses, I was a bit off my head and I'd bring a lot of that bad energy home, that work energy. But I've worked really hard that when I come home with the family, I clock off and, you know, it's all about them. Yeah, it's an added responsibility, mate. And I talk to guys and ladies who want to start their own businesses with kids and they're hesitant to do it, you know, because of the risk. But I always think that you've got to think about your own life a bit. I'm not saying you got to be selfish, but you do have to think about your family's got to be first, but your own health has got to be important too. You don't want to be a cranky old grandfather who never achieved your goals because your kids, you got to find that balance. So I've always tried to have that balance because I knew it was important to be who I wanted to become.
You mentioned that you had started flying. So you actually had, I guess, a supplementary business within the aviation space. That business is still running today.
Yeah. So when I left Warrnambool and I left Colin, I came back to Toowoomba because the kids were all getting ready to go to school and my parents had retired. So I wanted to come back and be close to them, to care for them. So we settled in Toowoomba where I went to boarding school. But I had to turn a buck then and I just fell into corporate aviation. So I set up a business flying and managing corporate jets and quite a few, mainly in meat, in the meat industry. So quite a few of the meat companies in this country, you know, we've set up their corporate divisions or flown their planes. And that's a great little business that gave me an income. I started doing a bit more property developing then. We had some good times and some bad time in that. And I just waited until DIT got to a stage where I just felt I need to give it all of my focus. So yeah, the aviation business still ticks along and I love that. It's a big part of my life. But my focus is now building DIT.
So that, I guess, inflection point where it went, okay, we're all in, we're rolling the dice, I'm backing myself and we're building a team. For people who haven't come across DIT AgTech before, firstly, let's talk about the name, DIT. Yeah. Does it stand for something?
Well, we started, it was direct injection technology we started off with.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone used to call it DIT. So then we just started calling it DIT. Then everyone would say, well, what's DIT? And then we'd have to do the story, well, it's an ag tech business. So in fact, one of our people lead, Ellie, she said, why don't we just put ag tech on the other end? So that's what we've done.
Simple as that.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. Yeah. I wish there was some other funky reason to it, but that's how it came about.
And so can you explain to our listeners, I was fortunate to kind of see it yesterday, how it works. Can you explain to them how it actually works and maybe what are the benefits of it?
So what we've tried to do is, so we basically build hardware.
Mm-hmm.
That measures water flow. We put a water meter in the water line where the water goes to all the livestock. And off the back of that water flow, we can sort of program a controller with some software to make some decisions around, okay, that much water, there's this many cattle. And then we inject into the water a certain amount of supplement. And within that liquid supplement is urea and phosphorus and ammonium sulfate and a whole range of other soluble additives that provide them with all the production they need in lieu of doing lick blocks and dry lick. And then what we do is we hook those doses up to telemetry. So, and then we display all that on a dashboard where we can remotely control the doses from anywhere in the world and we pull data out of it. So we can see in real time how much crude protein a group of cattle are getting and how much phosphorus. And then off the back of all that, because we can measure now, we can start to manage production so our customers can increase or decrease dose rates. And it was off the back of that platform that we built that we fell into the climate opportunity around reducing methane. And we've got a big focus at the moment on building out that across the platform now. So we make all the animal health products. I say to people, we're a bit like the Coke vending machine. Mm-hmm. You know, we make the Coke machines. We put the Coca-Cola in there. The customers just pay for the Coke. So 90% of our revenue at DIT comes from our enterprise business where we own all the technology. We own all the assets on farm. We do all the work. We fill all the tanks up. We collect all the samples. You know, we measure everything. We give all the dashboards free of charge and then our customers only have to pay a price per litre. That's where 90% of our revenue comes from. And we went that way because we had to solve another problem in tech, because farmers don't really want to own tech in the middle of nowhere, because you know they want to know that there's someone to give them customer service and going to rock up, and that was a big thing that when we created our enterprise business we really started to scale then, because we were solving a labor problem for them and we were backing the tech.
Why would a farmer use it? As in, what are the options and what's the value and the benefit to them in using it?
Well, instead of putting out lick blocks everywhere over 1 million acres, you know, it's a huge job. But there's not the wastage. You know, we can be cheaper, but we can actually, they've got an opportunity to manage production. You know, they can change from urea or more phosphorus based. They can measure their performance. If they're one of our enterprise customers, we do all the work. So they don't have to worry about putting out lick blocks. They can focus on other things they're doing with their herd management or their CapEx projects that they might be running. And we look after all the labor form.
Hi, I'm Pia, horticulture and sugar analyst at Rabobank, and I'm here to share our latest insights on Australia's vegetable market. Did you know in 2023, Australia produced over $5.8 billion worth of vegetables, though only 4.3% of this was exported? Like many other countries, the Australian vegetable industry relies mostly on its domestic market, In fact, only 7% of global vegetables produced are traded between countries. But we are starting to see that trend change. Global trade is growing at a faster rate than production, and countries with low-cost production are seeing the highest growth rates. You can learn more about trends in the vegetable market on our latest Rabo Research Australia podcast, Mapping World Vegetable Trade, or reach out to me via the Rabobank Australia social media channels to learn more.
And so I think, I know it even in my line of work, that Australia's a big place. For you guys, you're choosing to serve, started off really in Northern Australia, servicing them. One, you can probably get more remote, and also two, getting people in there. So like, how'd the business grow? Was it you in the early days literally running around?
Yep, with a couple of other guys, literally going up to the territory, putting one doser in, then two, then five, and then putting on a couple of staff, and then finding another customer. But we worked really hard to find what I call influencers in areas. You know, we knew, because I had all these years of experience, I knew that the way to sell a product or an opportunity, or an offering, was you really need to get, you need to find influencers. You know, people need to talk about it. You could do all the advertising in the paper you want to. So we picked innovative graziers that were happy to give us a go.
Mm-hmm.
And then other farmers would look over the fence and say, well, if this person's doing it, it must be good. And then there'd be a conversation. Then we'd have a chat to someone else, and we've just built it out like that.
So I'd love for you to tell me on the business front how you've gone in your changing role, obviously from being so hands-on, literally screwdriver in hand, putting these things in, but also being able to see what was possible, staying across what was happening. As you mentioned, you guys have now gone down the climate pathway as well. So not only is it on the production side where you guys can add trace elements to support livestock production, there's things like reducing methane. How have you stayed across all of that?
Like, I'm still a really hands-on sort of leader. I think it's important. I try to spend most of my time in two places, one with my team, or two with my customers. And because you can remotely, I can stay on top of strategy. But I think I can just stay all over it because I love it so much, Ollie. You know, I mean, I'm passionate about it. It's like I get out of bed and I think of a new idea and say, hey, we could do this, and it's fun and it makes me feel alive and I love going to work. But I'm really lucky. I'm really lucky. I think that's helped me because I'm so invested in what we're doing. I think it's really important what we're doing for our farmers. I really want to try to do something to help our industry. You know, I'm concerned where agriculture is going. I'm really concerned about where the positioning of livestock in the world, you know, the narrative around their bad. I've always been a great believer that ruminant animals will unlock potential we've never realised to be more better custodians of our planet and produce more sustainable red meat and all that. And I just wanted to be part of it. So jumping out of bed every day trying to solve methane and build all this, for some reason I can just stay on top of it.
So I want to ask you on that, because I'd say, and why I'm picking your brain on this is, I feel like I'm quite similar to you in lots of ways. How do you go matching your energy and your enthusiasm and the ideas to then also maybe what the team can keep up with and keeping them, I guess, where their time and energy is needed, which is in the here and now?
That's a real good question. It's a good question, because I think if you're so driven, you've got to be careful that you don't become so crazy that people don't, you know, want to be around. So I'm mindful of that.
Yeah.
You know, I pick my time, but I try to set the pace. I try to inspire the team to, you know, have a crack at stuff themselves. You can't do it all yourself. I definitely realize that, you know, but I think part of being a really good founder of any business that's starting off from nothing is being really good with people, you know, about building teams. And I wish I could say that there were all these traits in people to be great team members that you learn at university. I think there are fundamental lessons you learn about people. But as you get older, I become more attuned to people. I try to spend time to feel what their energy is like and where they come, what's their motivation, would they be a good fit? Yeah, and set the pace like that and set the goal and, you know, the enthusiasm. People need to see the leader enthusiastic about life and that it's important and they will follow you.
When hasn't it served you?
Probably when it's been really hard financially, you know, because it's not for everyone working in these sort of businesses.
Mm-hmm.
It probably hasn't served me when in the early days when you're talking to big corporates, people who run big corporates. To run these sort of businesses, you are an outliner, so you are on the edge, mm-hmm. and I've identified that early on. So making sure that you're not too, you know, when you're trying to get new customers, you just got to not be too crazy on your thinking or think too fast.
Yep.
That's been something I've had to work on really hard.
And what about on the people front? What's probably, is there a revelation or a moment or something that you really recall? Maybe even if it was a time where you felt like, wow, I've really grown into this and matured into my role as a manager.
I can tell you when that was, Ollie, was when we did a couple of, we've done three crowdfunds in DIT. And I even get a bit emotional thinking about this, was when I could see my staff on the platform investing their money. So they were working for us. And at the same time, they were investing back in the business, buying shares. And I sort of really felt that we've got something here, you know, we're doing really good. It was great.
What's it like to have that vote of confidence? Like you'd come up with this vision, you're so passionate and driven about it, to have people put their hand in their pocket for you.
It's very humbling, mate. And it's a huge responsibility, you know, and I don't take it lightly.
Mm.
But it was probably what I realised. Crowdfunding was really good for us. You know, crowdfunding got a bad rap. And I'm the greatest supporter of crowdfunding. You know, like I just think it's the most fantastic way for young people to raise capital to fulfil their vision and their dream. But when you see people investing in your business because they're investing in you or they're investing in people, like people buy people. People don't buy spreadsheets or PowerPoints, you know. People will look at businesses or leaders and say, that aligns with my own thoughts or my own feelings, and I want to be part of that. Not just financially, but I want to be part of change. Crowdfunding was a defining moment for me in DIT to see all these mums and dads and young kids putting $250 in and $500 and $1,000. You know, we haven't been funded by the big VC, nothing. Everything that DIT's done has been the complete opposite to way the storybook should go with venture capitalists and everything. We've gone down a completely different road.
What gave you the confidence to do that? Like, one, it's an idea to be able to do it, but then to actually go, you know what, stuff it, let's go and increase the number of shareholders. Let's see what we can do with the everyday person.
Well, mate, we needed to raise capital. You know what I mean? Like, I remember the day, I remember reading in the financial review about how ASIC was changing the crowdfunding and allowing crowdfunding. I'd sort of heard about it. It was, you know, traditionally crowdfunding was where it was like a GoFundMe page. You know, you had some disease and you need to raise money. And so it had a bad rap to start with. But when I'd heard about these platforms, you know, I could see, hey, this is a way to raise capital. And this is a way that everyday people would potentially buy into what our vision was for the business. We just had to articulate it correctly. I just felt that, well, we had to do it. You know, we had to raise money. Otherwise, it was going to stop. The business was going to,
And was it as simple as that? Like in the sense of, I guess, you going, well, we can either trickle along or we can get this injection of money and we can kind of move forward. Like, how did it complicate things?
Oh, well, it did. You know, of course, there was a lot more governance all of a sudden. You know, you don't have to be a public company to raise money now in crowdfunding. But when we did our first crowdfund, part of the regulations, you had to be a public company. So we had to incorporate a public company.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start a public company, you got to get audited every year. There's a whole level of governance that we'd never done. So we had to learn all that. But it wasn't that hard really, mate. It was, you know, just a process. I think the hardest thing was making sure we identified early on, and this is why I'm such a big believer in storytelling. You know, great businesses always have a great backstory, and that's what forms those businesses when they become big, mature businesses. So it's important for a founder to embrace your story. Everyone's got a different story. So we really embraced our story. We spent money on a video. You know, we used that for a promotion to buy in our business. We traveled around the country trying to let people really understand what we're doing. We went up to the territory and did filming, and we went here and, you know, all over the joint. We did it, and it was a great video. You know, we've done them better since then, but that's what got us going.
I want to go and watch this video because we're chatting about it over dinner last night. There wouldn't be too many, I'll say, founders, but also managing director, CEOs of publicly listed companies that would jump in a helicopter and do their own their own drop-ins and whatnot.
But we've done everything at DIT to survive. You know, like it's there's been a lot of crazy stuff we've had to do, but it's allowed us to survive. It's allowed us to keep going until we could build our revenues and we could get profitable to where we are now. So, you know, when we start raising money now in the business, it's more about strategic raising for new initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the early days, it was survival. You know, we had to get money to put someone on to try to build out the business. Yeah.
At what stage did it change? Going, like, was there a day that you can recall where it went from we're literally getting by, trying to survive, to keep supporting people's livelihoods, to going, okay, maybe we've got over that hump?
Oh, probably about 12 months ago. We've got a new chairman he won't mind me saying his name, Andrew McPherson. He's a good mate of mine. You know, he came from a CEO of the second biggest meat company in Australia. He believed in what we're doing. He led around. He invested his own money in the business with quite a few other corporate professional people. That was a defining time because all of a sudden I felt like we finally had people investing in the business that were at the pinnacle of agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
That took a while, but that was a defining moment because we really, in my mind, became a real business then. You know, we had a real board. Some of our members were there then, but we've got a great board, very professional, all professional people. So you go from a scruffy startup with all this chaos and all this to starting to really mature. Such an exciting time for us right now.
A real business. Now, tell me a bit about your staff because I think that's also a bit of a, I'll say a lesson and journey in itself. I think, yeah, right, you literally had these highly skilled people who were in different areas, driving Ubers, doing tasks which weren't anywhere near their skill set or what they were actually capable of. How did you come across that? And what's made you, I guess, the right person but the right fit for, what do we work out, 11 or 12 different nationalities?
Mate, if there's a few things that I've done at DIT, the thing I'm most proud of is our team. You know, our multiculturalism, our diversity, like it really is, it's great to be able to lead such a diverse team. But that happened because, you know, we needed staff. Initially, we needed tech staff. We couldn't get tech staff. We had one Jack who just happened to be in Townsville. You know, he was really our start with our tech. Jack sort of led our tech team. Well, he's an Aussie, but he was raised on a dairy farm in New Zealand. But that was the beginning. But when we started to need to put staff in the business, we couldn't get staff. We couldn't get them to come to Townsville. And we had a lot of immigrants applying for jobs. And so we started putting a few on. And, you know, I learned how to manage that and how to grow that. So of the just under 50 people that work in the business, 30 of them would be immigrants. And we would have never built the business out without the multiculturalism and what we're doing. So that's a big part of the business. So many young people that have come here have got masters in IT and engineering and finance, and they've moved from other countries to become Australian citizens and to contribute to our economy and all of those things. And they've come along and they've helped us on where we're going. So the multiculturalism, and then, you know, I know we spoke about last night, another part that really changed was when we had to get staff in the north to work in our delivery drivers. And we just, you know, we were employing locals from the north, and it was challenging getting the right sort of people. And I remember the day when I had a moment. I was at the Downlands Toowoomba Grammar rugby match in Toowoomba. It's a big footy match, and I was there walking around seeing all these old mates of mine from school, and, you know, they were telling me these stories, how they'd sold the family farm and they'd moved to Toowoomba, and, you know, their wife was working in a medical centre and they'd put the kids through school and they wanted to do this and wanted to do that. But what they really wanted to do was get out, back out in the bush. And it was just like a light bulb. I said, geez, like, what a resource. Here's a heap of guys that we could employ tomorrow. So we advertised on social media for FIFOs, and that's a big part of our workforce now is middle-aged ex-farmers who we fly in and out of the north, and they do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. That was a big turning point too in solving our labour problem in remote areas.
I feel like you could have a huge influx of people that would be like, it sounds like a great kind of holiday, but also an outlet where they can kind of get out. And if, like, could someone come and do it literally for kind of 6 months, 12 months, fly in, fly out?
We've got fellas been with us a couple of years now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I sort of wonder sometimes whether I should become a FIFO because they have great lives. Every 2 weeks, they're what you're doing, and they're going off on holidays, or they're going camping, or they're going here. But yeah, we have a lot of people contact us, and I think it's an untapped resource. There's two things. Labor's a big problem in the bush, as you know, Ollie, but we need to think outside the box a bit. You know, we need to go down that road less traveled, and we need to really explore the opportunity for immigrants to come and work in our industry. We need to look at how we can get mature people back into our industry. The fly in, fly out model, you know, people said, oh, it's not going to work because I'll go and work in a mine for twice the money. I never thought that they would, because what they were wanting was a regular wage to do something they were passionate about at a stage in their life where they weren't looking for money. And it's worked really well.
I think while we're talking about money, let's talk about, like, the lessons around the importance of profit in a business. I think totally get that you guys are purpose-led and you've got that ability to bring people in on that. And I'd say you have a unique skill set in that, how you can paint the vision, but also then bring people along that. I think huge credit to you. And what's probably amazing, and I'd just, you know, love to understand more of, is people talk about diversity and all the power, but actually I presume as a manager where you're dealing with, yeah, multiple people in, with multiple backgrounds, there's issues and family things that are happening back home. Like people might be physically present, but maybe not at all. Like as a manager, how have you been able to, I guess, adapt or what have you learned about actually managing a diverse team?
Really simple thing, you got to care. You know, as a leader, you need to care for your staff and you got to know that you've got their back. You know, I have a real open door policy with my staff and I'm actually proud that, you know, they all come to me when they have some personal thing happening because I think you've got to be a leader where they feel comfortable that you're there to watch over them and help them to navigate things. So that's the first thing. You got to really, really care and you got to understand their cultures and embrace it. But most importantly, just being a leader that you care for them, because people are looking for that in businesses, you know, not just the financial stuff. They're looking for a family, a community, that we're all aligned on this vision, but at the same time, we've each got each's back.
And then what about the learnings around profit and actually being comfortable with saying it's all, like, yes, we've proven we can raise money, but at the end of the day, we need to, as you say, I think you talk about profit being the oxygen.
It's taken me a while to understand the importance of purpose in a business, you know. And again, I think that when you get older, you start to reflect on, you know, what is important. I think just building businesses for money is not sustainable, you know, for me. There are people that do it, but that's not me. I think what's important is building businesses that are purposeful and useful and can make a difference. You know, I actually get challenged in society when I see the valuation of some of these gaming companies and online casinos, you know, these billionaires. And I think to myself, like, it's great, but it's just for convenience. If those people challenge their energy into building these purpose-led businesses in climate or food, what we could actually achieve. So I think purpose is really important. You know, for me as a leader, I want to do something. I want to have a legacy around the business. But you just, profit is like this close second right behind. You've got to make money. You know, you've got to get a return for your investors. Profit is the oxygen that allows us and gives us the right to be purposeful, basically.
I think it's such an important part to talk about. And I'll say especially in tech businesses, but especially in agriculture. Like, people are so tied up and passionate about what they do. I think the purpose side of things is fantastic. But if you actually want to be around next week, next year, like, you've got to be covering that margin.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a bit like, I think the agriculture's got such an opportunity to contribute more than just food in time, especially around this whole climate debate and sustainability. Mm. So we're really positioning ourselves to be at the forefront to help our customers to be able to capture these opportunities that are coming. I think you'll see in 50 years that they won't be Google's or Microsoft, the biggest businesses in the world. I think the biggest businesses in the world will be purpose-led impact businesses that are making a difference to humanity on food and climate and space exploration and all of those things. And I hope I'm right. You know, we're putting our toe in the water with the new business that we have spoken to you about, that I do believe that society is ready to invest in those sort of businesses, but we've got to get them a return too.
And being an advocate, like, on the forward facing, I think, like, in one of the purpose or mission statements of what you guys do, it's about a thriving agriculture sector, but also a thriving planet Earth. And I think, like, language is so important, but also at the same time too, it's really easy to, I guess, conform to what society expects. But the things that you talk about, the importance of caring about planet Earth and talking proactively around climate and the agriculture's role in being a solution towards it, it can be uncomfortable.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially in rural circles.
My take on the climate debate is this: it doesn't really matter whether you're a climate change believer or climate cycle. I've got my own personal views, which is probably doesn't really matter to anyone, but I've got my own personal views. I think looking after the planet is really important. I've never, ever had a debate from any farmer who doesn't believe in animal welfare, sustainability, and be a custodian of the land and looking after nature. I don't think farmers probably realise that they're probably the greatest greenies and an animal liberationist and environmentalist that I've ever met. But I think it's somewhere in between, and it's more around sustainability and sustainability for the environment, the atmosphere, sustainability for our food systems, sustainability as humans, you know, our mental health and where we're all going and being happy. It's such a big debate and it's such a big problem why I believe that we'll see businesses pop up that will solve these big problems that we've got.
I think it's, yeah, like the part for me with agriculture, like right now, and where I think the superpower is for us as a sector, is like the world's craving leadership. There's so much volatility in all these different areas. And it's like, well, one foundations of life is food, but then everything that kind of comes to that, as you've said, how we care for animals, so showing that care for other things, how we care for other people, how we're looking after the environment, and kind of acknowledging that evolutionary processes happened of we did things in the past because that's how it was done, and we don't have to throw it out and kind of say, oh, no, that was terrible and that was shit. Well, actually, what we've done, we were able to learn from that and go, well, how do we keep moving forward?
Yep. Yeah, no, agriculture's got a big part to play. You know, red meat is such an interesting debate in that around, you know, the fake meat and all. You know, my views are in 1,000, 2,000 years, I think as we evolve as a species, we probably won't eat sentinel beans. That's my view.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a long, long way away. And red meat will play a really important part in humanity, that, you know, for cognitive growth for infants and all of these things. We need protein. But we've got to take hold as a sector, we've got to take hold of the narrative. We need to get better in agriculture about telling the story that the masses want to hear. Not the story we think we want to tell about ourselves, the story they want to hear. And the story that I think that people in metro areas are wanting to hear, that farming is really important, food's really important, we're great custodians of the land, we believe in animal rights. You know, the issue is, as a business, live export is a great example. We've just got completely pounded because they've got momentum in this story that's taken place. And I know lots of live exporters in those industries, and they're just such wonderful advocates for animal care and all of those things. And even what we're doing with live export, we're delivering protein to countries that need it. You know, they've got a right to develop those countries, and we've got an opportunity, and we seem to be being stopped by all this stuff. But we've got to have leadership. We need leaders. We need people who can market and tell the right story.
Totally. Let's quickly touch on, so what does the future look like for you guys? What's next? What does the road ahead look like?
So we're really, of course, you know, we have a pretty defined strategy. And as you grow as a business, you know, you start to really focus on your strategy. What are we going to do? So we call our primary economic engine in DIT our animal nutrition business. So putting urea and phosphorus in the water, that's where we grow our revenues, where we can make profit. And we really work hard to defend and protect that, because that business gives us the right to invest in the next horizon of where we see opportunities. And the next horizon for us is moving into horticulture. So we've started a team. We've starting to build a team in horticulture. We see opportunities to bring our dosing technology and our software to that industry. It's very traditional still. And probably the most exciting opportunity for us is around building out a platform to reduce methane. We could see early on that solving the methane problem wasn't about the additives, Ollie. It was all the narrative. It was where all the money got. But that was not the problem to solve. You know, when you look at the red meat industry in Australia, 8% of cattle are in feedlots and dairies, and they're not the biggest emitters. Like they emit, the biggest emitters are in our extensive pasture base, and we had to work out how we're going to deliver these additives at scale. So we're working really hard on now. We have a product. We're putting in the water now. We've just about got a carbon project registered with Vera, so a person can buy a dose and be part of a carbon project and create additional revenue. So for me, is trying to unlock that revenue potential for our farmers, because farming is difficult, as we know. And I really want to try to develop these carbon opportunities where farmers don't get left behind as price takers yet again in this carbon, but we can become price makers. So we're looking at ways on how we can sell farmers' credits to consumers, environmentally conscious people, and try to get a better price for our farmers. So that's a really exciting project. So I think we'll move into the climate tech space. I would say in the next 5 years, more of our revenue will come from carbon than what it will from supplementation, but sort of the nexus between climate tech and ag tech.
I think the future sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, mate, you've got to do something between birth and death, haven't you?
So what's keeping you involved? Why are you still involved, and why will you keep being involved in agriculture?
Oh, I think it's because I love it, you know. I love the people. I think it's important. I'm really passionate about, you know, seeing our industry thrive, especially the beef industry and the sheep industry. I hate seeing the hard knocks we get from, you know, minority groups, and I'd like to be able to, you know, prove some people wrong that all the things that we're hearing is incorrect, which I know they are. Will I retire? No, I won't. No, I don't want to retire. That's not, it's not, you know, I'm having too much fun now. Like, my wife keeps telling me that I'm over 50 now, so I'm entitled to go to an over 50s home, but that'll be the last thing I'll be doing. But no, I'll keep running the business as long as the board and, you know, the shareholders have support in me, and yeah, see where the journey takes me.
Probably one thing we haven't touched on is, like, how have you learned to be able to look after yourself, to continue to keep up the momentum, to be able to think clearly, and what are some of the things that you prioritize week to week, day to day?
Yeah. I know that you're passionate about mental health, you know, I've seen things online about that, and I'm happy to admit that, you know, I've had mental health issues where I've got really low and everything. But I started really exercising in my 40s. You know, I've had some hard times financially, and I've been down some really dark, dark roads. But I came across running and, you know, looking after my self health and exercising and the importance of sleep and, you know, moderation on how many goal stubbies I have, all those things, and the importance of being able to turn my brain off so that I can be present with my family. But when I'm at work, turn it back on so I'm present with the team here. That's been the way that I've, and I'm a great believer that, you know, all of the things to help us, I know that there are genetic things that we have problems with mental health, but exercise is so important. You know, self-help around the right foods, going a bit easy on the grog and putting your running boots on and going for a run through the bush and sitting in the sun in the morning and just getting away from your phone. All those things seem fluffy. But they're all free and they're very important. So I leverage all of them.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So I think your career is fascinating, where you started in Central Queensland with your family on a station, you've gone, worked up north, you've been a helicopter pilot, you've worked in the south. You're now, I'll say it again just because it kind of blows me away a bit, but you're managing a business with 12 different nationalities and, I guess, diverse cultures. If you were chatting to students today, Year 10 students especially, like, what would you say to them about why they should consider a career in agriculture and what are those possibilities for them in the sector?
I think I'd tell it that it's a really important job. You know, you can really contribute to something. It's fantastic to be with nature. You know, it's the people are great, the opportunities, and the opportunities, I think, in agriculture are even more now than what they were 50 years ago. You know, there's a few things we've got to solve. I think we've got to have a debate at some stage around the capital allocation. We need to get more young, what I call zero starters, into the bush. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to find a way that year 10 student that wants to have that vision to own their own farm, that we can get them into their own farm. We need those sort of passionate people who are going to try to do innovative things. But I'd also say to those people that, you know, getting out in the bush, the people and the things you'll see and all that is, yeah, it's fantastic.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for having me up here and sitting down for a chat. I think your story is fascinating. I'm excited to see what's ahead for you guys. So thank you.
Thanks, Ollie. Yeah, so appreciate you coming up here, and everyone at DIT's enjoyed having you up here and telling you about what we're doing. So yeah, keep up the good work, mate. We think you're doing a great job. You're a great advocate for agriculture and, you know, for what we're doing. So you're doing a wonderful job.
No, thank you. And I think it's probably the exact same way that you feel about DIT is the way I feel about it. It doesn't really feel like a job. It's a heck of a lot of fun and doing something important. So yeah,
we're very lucky. Thanks,
thank
mate.
You. Well, that's it for another episode from us here at Humans of Agriculture. We hope you're enjoying these podcasts. And well, if you're not, let us know. Hit us up at hello@humansofagriculture.com. Get in touch with any guest recommendations, topics, or things you'd like us to talk and get curious about. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend, rate, subscribe, review it. Any feedback is absolutely awesome and we really do welcome it. So look after yourselves, stay safe, stay sane. We'll see you next time. See ya.